I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. I'm so humbled to welcome my guest for this episode because this fella is the real deal. He doesn't mince his words. World-renowned DJ Fat Tony has been paving the way for UK's current music scene for the past three decades.
Putting down drinking and drugs, as I said before, which were the crutches of what I used on, I was starting to work on myself and find out who I was and what really made me tick. And did I actually want to be a DJ?
As one of fashion scene's go-to performers, he is the official DJ to the Beckhams and Versace. Irving Welsh is making a film version of Tony's autobiography, I Don't Take Requests, which is also a Sunday Times bestseller and winner of the Attitude Book Award. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Tony, thanks for coming in today, mate. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I know we spoke about this a while ago, but it took me a while to get this off
like,
the ground.
Like most addicts, it takes a very long time to get there.
24 years. Yeah, I was sober when I was going to do this. I wanted to say, I saw you, was it 2 weeks ago, at Sushi Samba?
Yeah.
I was talking to my wife. Turned around, I saw you, and not in a voyeur way, but I was looking at you. And you looked smart, put together. You just looks really amazing.
Thank you.
And it really warmed me because after listening to your book and knowing what you've been through and my story, I know what it's like and where you come from and it wasn't how you was dressed. It was your aura and your energy. It was like confident but kind, cool, and just owned that space. And I was like, and went over.
Yeah, it's taken like 17 years to find that confidence.
Yeah,
when we get into recovery, we put down the drink and the drugs, which we use for crutches, for everything, and then the insecurity and everything else takes over, and then normally there's a shift in addiction. So whether it will go to food, sex, shopping, there's always a shift, and it's about dealing with those shifts and getting to the point of those shifts where you understand those shifts and you understand yourself more. Because for me, I can always look confident, but I'm the most unconfident person in the world.
But the last year or so, it's changed. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it that changed? Is it just time and all the work you've put in incrementally?
If you want me to be completely 100% honest, which I always am these days, it was honesty. It really was. You know, the fact that I opened my mouth and said, okay, what you're seeing isn't really what's going on. And I was really good at painting a picture. And I no longer have to paint that picture. I am who I am, and you get what you get.
Yeah.
And, it's just dealing with stuff and confronting it and talking about it. And I found, like, from being honest, there's a real confidence because I don't feel less than.
Well, I guess you're not hiding. Yeah, you can own yourself.
Yeah.
I love that what you said because it's for years and years I kept holding on to stuff and hiding. Mm. And nothing to do with work, but my agents would always say, as a model in the 90s, you had to be mysterious, not really know what you was about, where you were from. And I put a great shop front on, but it was painful, really painful towards the end.
Well, that's your job, right? You know, it's like being an actor. It's like being in... We get paid to go and to be the person that people want to see. So when you're modelling, you're putting on clothes, you have your free looks.
Or taking them off.
Or in your way, you had one look. the other three was kind of like, all right, thanks, Paul. We'll leave that one there. But, you know, you had this look and you had this persona that you turn into when you do the job. And like me, Phil, when I DJ or I do what I do, I had this image that I kind of had to live up to, whether it be the car crash image or the face of recovery or any of these things. I always manipulated the situation, whether it be a good situation or a bad.
Yeah.
And now I don't have to do that. Do you know what I mean?
100%. I read your book. I didn't read your book because I'm dyslexic too. I listened to your book.
Yeah.
And for those who haven't read it, I actually cried on a couple of bits.
Oh, thank you.
Laughed
job
and stuff.
Well done.
Yeah, no, seriously. And also I was like, biting my knuckle, going, no, don't do that. And it's through the honesty of that journey that was incredible. How did that come around and how did you write it with Michael?
So basically, with Michael Hannigan, he'd been doing like loads of interviews and stuff with me for 10 Magazine, and we did like loads of editorial for GQ and things like this. And Mikey had done a lot of things about the 90s and the 80s with me. And I'd been approached several times to do a book. I did a Mixmag documentary at the beginning of lockdown, just before lockdown, which got seen by like 9 million people during lockdown, which was like a blessing for lockdown because people had nowhere to go. So I had to watch it. But on the back of that, I was like, okay, well, I've talked about the, you know, various things in that film. And I just think I really wanted to just put everything out there. And how the book started out was not how it ended up.
How
because
did
it kept
start
going
out?
Back. It took 2.5 years to write.
Was that, was you dictating to Michael?
Yeah. So Mikey would come to my house and we would sit down and I would tell stories and go through stuff and talk about things. And at that time of that writing process, 3 days, 4 days a week, I was going through the worst breakup ever with the most toxic relationship I'd ever been in. On both sides. It wasn't just a one-sided thing. Yeah. The relationship had played out and there were learnt behaviours that were going on and it was awful. And so I was really vulnerable anyway. And then to start talking about stuff that I thought I'd processed and thought that I'd dealt with in my life, what I learned really quickly was everything that I was talking about and putting in that book, I'd never dealt with. Because I hadn't talked about it for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, doesn't mean I've dealt with it. So I go through life ploughing. I plow through. The drama that's in front will get pushed to one side and then I move on to the next one and then I forget about that last drama. Never dealt with any of it. And what happens is it all builds up. And up and up, and then eventually it will all cave in on you and you will drown. And what I did through that process of talking about abuse, talking about my father, talking about all of the things that I talk about in the book, the addiction part of it was probably the easiest part to talk about because I did that daily in meetings and I did that with my sponsors and or whatever I did within the fellowship stuff, the 12-step program. But the dealing with, like, the talking about being abused as a child, I thought I'd dealt with that stuff. I talked about it probably twice in my life.
Yeah.
But to me, it was dealt with because it no longer was an issue.
But it would make sense because you had acknowledged it.
Of course, but it was a major issue.
Yeah.
All of that stuff I dragged from relationship to relationship, you know. And to deal with that and talk about that stuff with Mikey was pretty hard. So when you're doing that, you kind of want the world to love you. You kind of don't want people to see you in a bad light. So you kind of fabricate things. And then I would move on to the next chapter and I'd be like, you know what? We need to go back to that chapter and change that because that's not true.
How did you feel with honesty in front of Mikey though?
Oh, great. Because Mikey knew me better than anyone.
I'm listening.
me and Mikey were like, it was loggerheads every day. I'd scream and shout at him, he'd storm out. You know, it was, that's why the book is so honest and so, it's done so well because it's a real book.
Yeah.
And there is no like fabrication. As I say, I kept going back to reading chapters. We'd have chapter reading days and I'd be like, no, we need to do that again. Because I don't even know why I said that.
Do you know what I loved as well? Is being a Londoner as well, hearing your London voice read it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was actually sitting there thinking, if he's really dyslexic, how the hell are you reading his whole book?
I did it an hour a day.
That's amazing.
An hour a day. Well, it was meant to be an hour a day, which took 3 hours a day. But like, because I'd start off the day like reading really well. And then I'd start reading two sentences ahead.
Yeah.
I would suddenly something would snap in me and I'd start reading like two sentences ahead and think, hang on, well, I'm lost. And then that would be enough. And then the guys that were doing with like, okay, let's stop.
Because there's a couple of lines you improvised in there and I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, well, yeah. There was a lot of improv. I mean, I was like, why the fuck have I put this person in my book? Because I'd only had one real read through of it.
Yeah.
In its entirety. I'd read every chapter several times, obviously, when we wrote them, and then we put them. And because we jumped from chapter to chapter when we were writing it, it wasn't written in one go,
yeah,
obviously. So when you put that stuff together and then you do a read through, I found it really overwhelming. And that was when I decided I no longer wanted to do the book. Once it was done, I thought, no one's getting their hands on this. Because it was...
Because you felt so...
Vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yeah.
Because once I handed it over, we handed it in to my publishers. And that night, I woke up at 2 a.m. thinking, what the fuck have you done?
Yeah.
Your life's really good right now. You've just completely ruined it. You've ruined it because... When you're that honest about things and there's stuff in there that I've never told anyone, which people don't do in books. They don't do that in autobiographies. They want to paint this picture.
Yeah. It's like Instagram.
One of the really early reviews of that book were that the only person that comes out of it unvarnished is me, but that's why you love him. And it was like, and I just wanted that book back. I was like, please, I don't want it to go. And they had to talk, obviously, the publisher, it was in the publisher's hands. And Hannah Black at Hodder, who was the woman that approached me in the first place, she was like, I just want to tell you, it's incredible. And I was like, I don't want anyone to read it. I had to really battle with it.
What was the defining sentence that made you go, you know what, let's just do it?
When Hannah came back to me and she rang me and she'd been crying and she was like, I just want you to know that, that you're going to change a lot of people's lives. And I was like, okay, let's, I'm happy with that. That's enough. Yeah. Do you get what I mean? And it was like that whole letting go, because I'm a control freak, it's like I had to let go of it. And it's probably one of the most freeing things I've ever done in my life. It's changed my life. That book is like the biggest, it was never meant to be a self-help book, ever.
It's amazing though that I always believe that if you speak from the heart, people hear it,
yeah,
and feel it.
I think that brutal honesty has really changed my life,
yeah,
from being that honest.
Especially when you come from the era we both come from. It's like sweep it under the carpet and the rug's totally up here, isn't it?
Totally. And, I was addicted to lying. I did 28 years of lying every day of my life. And that's a real learned behaviour to try and get rid of.
Yeah.
Because people wouldn't even ask me the time because I'd lie to them. Do you go in? Oh, yeah, it's 4 o'clock. Because it was easy. And also, when we get into recovery and we change our lives, we continue to lie because it serves us. So people ask us, how are you today? I'm going, oh, I'm great. I'm not great. I'm having a really bad day.
Yeah.
But, it's just about changing that thought process of, like, saying things for the sake of saying them.
Well, it's easier because you have to stop and deal with and think about it. For those who haven't read the book yet, you should. But how sober are you now? How many years?
I'm 17 years. 17 and a half years, in fact.
That's amazing. Yeah, so for those who haven't read your book, Tony, and should read it, what was it like growing up in London in the 70s?
Yeah.
67?
It was in the 70s and the 80s.
Like, what was your mindset?
I just... Because, certain things that happened at the age, early age, like abuse and stuff like that, my mindset was all over the place. I kind of really was overprotective of myself. But also at the same time, with an alcoholic father and lots of alcoholism going on in the family, there was always chaos. So I was always drawn to drama and I was always drawn to chaos.
Did you know that was alcoholism or did it seem normal?
Knew it was alcoholism. My aunt would lie around the corner from our house on the hill throwing cider bottles at buses.
Right.
And we weren't allowed to talk to her. And my dad would say, don't go near her, she's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And it was much easier for him to point the finger at her being an alcoholic than actually pointing the other four back at himself.
Standard.
Yeah. And that's what it is. We like to blame other people for our own...
I was younger, I still now, if I walk past the pub and I get that smell, I kind of feel like I'm being pulled into the pub.
Really, do you?
Yeah, I really do. And it's rare because the smoke's not there anymore, but I really have that sense. But I swore when I was younger that I wasn't going to drink because of stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly the same.
Because I saw what would be always nights and parties would end up violent, stuff would happen. And always. As a kid, I was quite, I'd say vulnerable, but open, and I could feel that energy change, and I'd be like, I need to get out of here.
I still feel that energy change now when I'm around people.
How do you deal with that now?
Because for me, other people's drinking isn't the problem. I'm the problem. My drinking is the problem. The way I drink, the way I do most things in an addictive way are always the problem. So for me, when I'm around that, because, you know, I work in those environments, I'm surrounded by drink and drugs constantly. For me, I couldn't think of anything worse than having a drink.
Yeah.
I never ever romanticize it. I never think, oh, I really miss that. Yeah, I was with someone yesterday who's doing the screenplay for the film adaptation of the book, actually Irvin Welsh, and we were talking about just the desire to want to drink. And he was talking about cider. And I was like, you know what? In the early days of getting clean, the only thing that I would romanticize was with pear cider. I hate pear cider. Pear cider. And I kept thinking, oh, I'd love to drink that. I'd love to try that. It must taste like pear drops. like literally just the insanity. Do you get what I mean? It was like, I was talking about it with Irv's yesterday, and I was just like, that's kind of insane. But, you know, for me, being in that environment, it's like a step one for me going to work sometimes. I look around, I just think, oh, so glad I'm not part of this.
That's a good perception, because when I feel the energy change, I just want to leave the building. Mm. And it's just memories of being a child, like, pub fights and stuff like that. I hate that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's normally, these days, it's normally me having the pub fight sober. like, literally, it's normally me, like, telling people about themselves. Yeah. I'm very good at that.
Just offering advice up.
Yeah, it's not advice.
When you said in the book about you went back to work pretty quickly, and basically, I went to an acting school, funny enough, around the corner, at 4 months... 10 months sober, so 4 months after I come out of the Priory. And the acting teacher was teetotal.
Yeah.
And he was a Buddhist monk, and he was the most amazing guy ever. And I basically went to his class twice a week for a year, but wouldn't want to go back to work, because I was like, there's no way I can go back because of all the partying and drinking drugs. And it was Donatella phoned me up and said, we've got an AIDS Foundation show in Vienna.
Yeah.
And I said, I can't do it. I said, I'm too scared to go back to work. He said, we'll look after you.
No one could look after you like Donatella. She's been through it. She's another miracle of recovery.
And she looked after me, and I felt really safe. Mm. And it was the first time. So it took me a year or so to go back. And I went back with a complete different view. It was really odd. It wasn't all about me and what we can get. It was like, wow, I'm having this experience with these people, and actually I was really protected, and it made me, thanks to her, I went back to work.
Mm.
But you went back really quickly. How was that?
For me to go back really, like, it was a year out. I took a year out. I was in rehab for 6 months, and then I kind of took the other 6 months just kind of glorifying in the fact that I was sober around town, and then I kind of went back, and I froze. I couldn't do it. What I'd forgotten was the actual reason I loved my job. It was because I loved music.
Yeah.
It was that reconnection with music that changed everything.
Did that happen organically?
Yeah, literally. The minute I stopped worrying about it, it happened.
What was you worried about?
What are people going to think? How can I be there? It was on me. It was literally on me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, putting down the drinking and drugs, as I said before, which were the crutches of what I used on, I was starting to work on myself and find out who I was and what really made me tick. And did I actually want to be a DJ? What was I going to do if I wasn't a DJ? Yeah. You know, so it was that moment of reconnecting with music and thinking, oh, my God, this really is the best drug in the world. So little by little, I started listening to music at home again, all my favourite tunes. I would listen to them. And then just suddenly, you know, the hair started to stand up on my arms and on the back of my neck. And that was that reconnection. That was that magical moment that I just thought, I know what I need to do.
It's amazing because music's so powerful. It can change the way you feel in an instant, can't it?
You know, literally, if I have a bad day, I walk into my house and I just literally say, play my tunes. Yeah. And I have a playlist.
Wait, is that to Alexa or to yourself?
To Siri. I don't play tunes. I don't take my job home with me anymore. No, literally, I just say to Siri, hey, Siri, play my playlist, and it will play all my favourite songs. And within within two tunes, I'm back in the place that I need to be. Because that's all it does. It has that power to shift. No line of cocaine or no line of any drug that you take will take you, transport you to that place of happiness. It's going to take you to a place of anxiety.
And that's such an illusion.
Music takes you to happiness if you want it to. It can also take you to sorrow. If you want to have a bad, if you're at home and you want to have that moment, you can get that from a certain track. Because, you know, with music, you can close your eyes and all of those people that are no longer with us are with us in that room because of that song.
Yeah, it's true.
It's amazing.
Do you meditate?
No, I don't. I tried it so many times. You know, with my severe ADHD, it was always a problem just to concentrate. I always make a joke of watching Coronation Street as like meditating for me because I switch off.
Yeah.
I can sit down and watch the most, I was going to say mundane, but it's not mundane. I can sit down and watch any TV program and instantaneously switch off. Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's like, you know, you can ask me a question and I won't answer you because I'm in a different place.
Yeah, I get that. Do you do any mindful practice or anything?
I used to at the beginning. Just do a lot of like a lot of tapping, a lot of breathing, a lot of, you know, it was different strokes for different folks for me. I had to try everything.
Yeah.
And what I found was the fact that just going for a long dog walk will change.
There's nothing better.
Take me to a different place.
Nothing better than that in nature.
No, that's it. Just getting out. If I'm in my head, I need to go out. I've learned, just leave the house. Change my environment. Don't sit in those same four walls. And the world changes.
It's really funny because in the beginning, I was so scared of relapsing that I did all the mad, like, 8-hour fucking meditations. I made myself, I've got to do 45 minutes a morning, 45 minutes a night. I can't do that. I didn't watch TV for a year. I didn't have a relationship or text anyone for a whole
year. Did you get a plant?
Yeah. Got two plants and a fish. No, but this was, it was like, I really thought towards the end for me, you know, I was going to take my life anyway. And when I was in rehab, something just happened. I don't even remember when. And someone said, look, you can start the whole thing again.
Because
it was a shame and guilt for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, they gave us like a green and gold book and a blue one. And I read it, just a couple of lines in there. And I read, you can look the world in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, when did I look anyone in the eye? Mm-hmm. What happened to the kid? What happened to me? So that for that first year, I wouldn't advise anyone to do it. But for me, I had to break everything.
Mm.
And there was many nights I'd sit there fucking crying, thinking I'm so lonely and stuff. But what it gave me was resilience to know that I'm okay on my own.
Yeah, but you know, what we forget is when we're in those moments of feeling lonely and isolated, how isolated and lonely we were when we were taking drugs.
100%.
Do you know what I'm saying, Char? It's the most loneliest place in the world.
Yeah.
Any form of addiction is the most loneliest place in the world, whether you're addicted to phone apps. You're on your own doing exactly what you would be doing, but you're not using cocaine, you're using a phone app.
Yeah.
All of the things that we take for granted on a daily basis, you know, it's how we put ourselves in our mindset that makes us lonely. You know, I can have a weekend off work, which is very rare these days, but I can have 2 days off work and I can be on social media looking at everyone else working. And that's it. My career's over. My life's over. Everyone hates me. I'm just on my own. It's like, what? Literally,
negative
can still
Nelly.
Go there. And the amount of work that I've done on myself, I can still go there. But these days, it doesn't last longer than 10 minutes.
That's the thing. Because when I heard someone say that when I was first around, and they said, oh, yeah, I still get these thoughts and I still get that. I thought, why are you in recovery? I don't want to be like that.
Yeah, but they're thoughts.
Yeah. And I didn't realise it then, but now I understand I'm not my thinking and it doesn't last long.
And it's a thought. And how long does a thought last? As long as you allow it to last.
Exactly.
Right. And, you know, I used to be allow it to last a month, 2 months. Oh, I'm just a piece of shit. Blah, blah. Now I had these thoughts and I laugh at them and I shake them out of my head. Yeah. I'm literally like, oh, shut up, Tony. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I literally had to just laugh at them.
But to do that, you have to have done a lot of work yourself.
100%.
Clearly.
100%. You know, I've done so much work. A lot of it, you know, did it mean anything? Did it change anything? I could say no, but then again, I'm sitting here and I'm probably in the most happiest place I've ever been in my life. I'm full of gratitude. I'm full of happiness. I'm full of, I'm kind of resentment free on lots of levels. You know what I've learned is to, instead of harboring a resentment, I just deal with it there and then. I tell you, you know, you're behaving like a complete and utter, and we leave it at that. Do you know what I mean? I say my piece and then I move on. It's done.
It's funny, we was having a discussion yesterday with someone about resentments and what is a resentment.
Yeah.
And it's just playing like a movie, playing that loop over and over. And the feeling is, I feel strong, I feel powerful, everyone can go do one. Mm. And it weirdly gives you an illusion of being strong. But actually,
you're
weaker because you're annihilating yourself, aren't you?
Yeah. The only person we're having a resentment with ourselves.
I've never had a resentment myself.
Every morning. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Are you a post-it note person? Do you like write little affirmations on post-it notes?
No.
Did you do that early days?
No, I never done that. Do you know what I did? I hung on for dear life, and I was literally. I remember I used to go back to the treatment centre I was in North London, and I used to sit there rocking like this on the thing because the emotions that I hadn't dealt with, that I didn't know I had a lot of trauma and stuff early on, and they said, look, come and do psychodrama. What's psychodrama? Just come and do psychodrama. We had to sit like we are now.
Yeah.
And I had to sit in the seat and be someone and talk to that person and come back. And I couldn't speak because I had so much, it was so much pain that it wouldn't come out. And I was like, and she, like I was on the gear. So I'm like, and she said, just stamp your feet, darling, on the floor. And I stamped my foot and I come to 5 minutes later, I'd smashed the whole room up. They called an ambulance, had cut all my hands.
Mad, right?
So yeah, it's quite emotional. And I couldn't remember it. And it was like, what was that? It's all the stuff I was burying. Then we did it again and again. And for me, it was like, I've never been able to say anything or talk. You put everything under the carpet. Mm. And I learned to communicate.
Yeah.
So I wasn't like fragrances and stickers. I was like, just get in there, mate.
Yeah.
Just fucking fight it. Like fight that thing inside.
I had a very similar situation when we were writing the abuse chapter in the book. And the day we started, I kept putting it off. And Mike would go, can we tackle this today? And I'd be like, no, I'm not in the right headspace for it. And then we got to the point where I was like, okay, let's do that today. And then half an hour in, I was projectile vomiting in my conservatory in my house, and I was like, like really bad, and I was like, oh my god, I've got food poisoning, and I was ill all day, and then I went to bed that night, and I could smell him in the room, I could see him, and what it had done was it had brought all that stuff up.
Yeah,
it brought it up and it made me violently sick. And it went on for about 3 days. And I seriously thought that I had, I was so severely vomiting and shaking. And what it had done was it just brought all that stuff that I'd been, completely ignoring for 30 years, 40 years, brought it all to the surface. And so that chapter was, probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. But probably one of the most freeing things I've ever done in my life, because the way it came out was so violent. Yeah, it was violent.
Which is a representation of how
I went through.
Yeah.
And now it doesn't have that hold on me anymore.
It's amazing. I got hypnotized when I was 23.
Yeah.
Right, about a situation like that when I was older, when I started to model, right? And I'm nervous saying it because in case my dad hears it, but I had something when I was new at modeling.
Yeah.
And I went to Paris.
Yeah.
And the agent I was with was not a good person.
No.
And they're like, you need to go and see this stylist. And I was shooting D&G campaign, Versace campaign, something else. I was really doing well. I was like, why have we got to go to his house if he's on the set for Oliver, whatever, glasses? Oh, no, he wants to see you at home. I'm like, but why would you not just bring the clothes to the thing?
Yeah.
So I said, can someone come with me? Because this doesn't sound right to me. And I went there, and I was 22, but I was really young-minded.
Yeah.
I was literally, like, not had no idea what was going on. And went to his house and he slammed the door. It was like, how dare you? Shouting through the door, bring someone here to me. And what the, and I found my agent, I'm like, it's really strange. Why not just see him on set? And I saw him on set the next day and he was a bit chippy. And I was like, I was a bit innocent. I was like, well, why is everyone being funny? He said, you've got to come to mine to come and try on this outfit tonight. And I'm thinking, why don't you just bring it? Anyway, against all my senses and gut feeling, I thought, well, I better go because he's got me on for a fragrance. And back then,
of course,
it was 800 grand for a fragrance. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And loads of stuff. Went to his place. He's like, I want you to try these on. Like a flannel, basically. The smallest pair of shorts. And do you know what, Tony? I was like, I felt like if my ancestors was in the room, they was going, don't do it. Don't do it, right? And I'm a boxer. I come from a fighting background. I tried these things on. Froze, and a guy fucking touched me and whatever and all that stuff. I ran out of that apartment crying. I just ran around Paris. I just done a loop to Paris. I went back to where I was staying. I was staying with an English photographer called Tony. He was from Bromley.
Yeah.
And he's a real meat and potatoes. And he went, what's the matter? And I was in bits. I went, I can't tell you. Something's just happened. I just can't tell you. And something switched from that day.
Yeah.
And I got cancelled for all the campaigns and all the jobs this guy had, the whole lot.
Because that was the power they had back then.
It was the power they had. My agent didn't want to know when I tried to tell her, so I left them. Couldn't tell anybody because I was like, I'm a guy, I'm a fighter, I can't, never experienced it. And that, I got hypnotised for it because it was so traumatic. But the woman at the time, she's like, we'll make you laugh because it's a happy thing. So whenever danger happened or I was in pain, I'd laugh.
Yeah.
So I'd have a few things go, like I had a crash on a motorbike and I was laughing and I really hurt myself.
I always think that when you get to a point where you can laugh at something, the power's gone from it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But especially with trauma.
That was
it takes
different.
A long time to get there.
Yeah. And I went back and revisited the whole thing properly. And just, you know,
I had a really amazing trauma therapist. She's still working with me now. She's writing, I'm doing a new book and she's going to be doing the sub chapters in it. And her name's Tara Day and she does trauma therapy. And she had me sitting on the floor, coloring crowns.
Yeah.
Because what happens is when we talk about stuff, the brain will only allow us to say so much.
Yeah.
And then when we start to color and draw, it opens up this part of our brain, like almost childlike. So I was like colouring pictures and she was like, why is his hair that colour? Why are you doing that? And I was like, wow, I didn't even, for the a year and a half that I had intense trauma therapy with her, that's how I got through writing the book. Yeah. And it just changed my perception on who I was.
See, I would have laughed at that years ago and I did art therapy.
Oh, you know what I mean?
Scene therapy and equine therapy. And I'd be like, why am I drawing this? And it was the same. It was amazing. It just opened up this other world. And I was like, oh, actually, that means something.
I realised I wasn't an artist as well at that point. cats and dogs are not the one. Do you know what I mean?
Not doing like, the gallery thing,
Fuck it out. Thank God I'm a DJ and not an artist. It's like, literally. But it kind of just changed everything.
Yeah. Well done for doing it, because a lot of people, it takes... I say well done, but at one point you have to do it. But a lot of people don't. There's people that take their life in recovery that don't not
they
willing
do.
To go there, right?
And you know the thing about it is, it's not about relapsing on drink or drugs. It's about mental health. Is about not only about your thinking. It's about what you put in your body and how you put things in and your speaking and everything. It's like any recipe.
If you take
one ingredient out, it's never going to be right.
No, I know. How do you get away with your Instagram then? Because it's
I don't give a fuck. Because I don't give a fuck. I literally had a big meeting the other day with new agents and they were all in the boardroom and I was like, okay, I've got one question. This was to the brand, like the brand ambassador people. And I was like, one question. And she was like, yeah, go on. I said, my Instagram, my social media. And she went, yeah. And I said, what do you think of it? She went, don't ever change it. And I said,
really?
Thank you. Because the last few agents I've had have always been like, oh, we might have to take the C word
Can't
out.
Say see you next
we
Tuesday.
Might have to do that. And I'm like, I've got it tattooed on my arm. I've got it written on my hand. I'm like, what do you want me to do? Chop my hand off? It's like, no, it's not happening. But yeah, it's, it, you know, I'm just, yet again, it's another avenue of honesty, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean?
And it's really nice at the moment because a lot of people are too scared to say anything or do anything.
They are. And you can't, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And we live in such troubled times. But, you know, there is a balance about do you get political or do you say what the rest of the world is thinking? And do you, you know, you just got to take it on the chin sometimes because, you know, people love to come for you. They love to drag you. And my theory is you can't come for me unless I call you.
Yeah,
I'll tell you when you can come. And until that point, stay in your fucking lane.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because we live in a world where everyone wants to challenge everyone. They think they have the right to.
100%.
That's the magic of social media.
Yeah. Do you think that's because you're a proper Londoner that you have that edge to you?
Well, I just think that I do. I was brought up to be the way I am. My dad was very adamant about, you know, knowing right from wrong and sticking up for yourself. And I've always been that way.
I totally got it with your dad. My dad's exactly the same. Mm. From an East London family and taught me a lot of stuff, taught me how to fight and defend myself at an early age. Doesn't like bullies, weren't about bullying or anything like that. But if you've got no choice, then this is what you
pick
have to do.
Pick up a brick, as my dad used to say to me.
Do you know what he did?
If you've got problem, if he's bigger than you, just pick something up.
If there's no brick, use a post. Yeah, if there's no post,
pick anything up. Literally, yeah. But it's, you know, I'm grateful for that because I do believe in sticking up for myself.
Well, you should, and I think today it's gone too far the other way. I mean, at one point it was too, in my upbringing, there was so much violence stuff, but not from my family and my dad, but and now it's gone really far the other way, and there's a balance, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a balance, and it's a healthy balance. You know what, I think the problem with social media is people have forgotten about being punched in the face for saying stuff, because you know what, so many people need a punch in the face, and you know, and people always go, oh, you can't say that, or you can't... If people understood the value of a good smack in the face for saying something, they wouldn't say it.
Because there's no consequences.
Of course there isn't.
That's the problem.
You know, they're sitting at home on their phones thinking that they can say what they want about anyone. And you know what? The world's bad enough as it is without that being added to it as well.
Be
happy for people, man. Be happy.
When I first went to LA, I was what, 22, 23? And my whole conversation was taking the piss out of people, basically. And I was never so misunderstood over there because they have a weird language. It's either therapeutic or military. Like, you're going to do this, you're going to take that, this is what's going to happen. Or it's like, oh, you're raising your voice, it's very offensive. I'm not sure how to take that right now, and you just don't know where to be. I found it really hard to navigate.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way I look at it, with the navigation thing, there's two types of people. There's cunts and there's us. And, you know, I kind of think once you've got worked that out, everything else falls into place.
But I don't think someone like me could go and say that because it sounds more offensive for me than you.
Oh, listen, I love that word. People get offended.
It is pretty much one of my favourite words.
By that. And it's only the ones that use it the most to get offended by it. Like, oh my God, you can't say it. I'm like, listen, I've got a clothing brand with it written all over. We use that word, you know, I've got it tattooed back to front on my arm, so when you take selfies with me, it comes out. So it's my engagement ring has got it written on. Look.
Yeah, which is brilliant. It's I used to go to a little meeting in LA, which was a little London meeting called See You Next Tuesday on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. How do you deal with stress now, Tony?
That's a good one. I've just started taking Lion's Mane, which is a godsend. I've just started on, I always tell people, yeah, I'm on mushrooms, and they think that I'm microdosing. I'm not. I'm just like on like Lion's Mane, and I'm taking three other mushroom extracts.
Richie mushroom's good for the brain as well,
yeah,
isn't it?
And you know, it's cleared that brain fog that I've had for many years, because I get stressed when I don't understand something. Right.
Yeah.
So if I'm having a conversation, my words won't come out because my ADHD. Some days my ADHD is on a 5, which is livable. Sometimes it can be 15, and that's
not fun.
Not fun at all.
Yeah.
Not fun at all, because it almost turns into a migraine.
Right.
Because I can't think, so therefore I'm over. My brain's overstimulating.
Is it because it's fast thoughts going through all the time?
And I forget what I'm doing. I forget what I'm saying. I'll call you, and I've forgotten what I'm talking about. And then that I get frustrated, and then I get stressed. And stress and me are not two good things together. So I kind of been taking lion's mane and a few other mushroom supplements in the mornings now, and it's leveled me out. Don't get me wrong, I still have the moments of stress. But, you know, I have so many things going on in my life that I try not to get stressed about. So if I do get to that point where I'm like, oh, my God, right, where, you know, what I've learned is it's really good to be angry because it's an emotion.
Yeah.
But when anger turns to rage, that's the black spot. That's the danger. You should never get to rage anymore. So I try to not allow things to get to that point. So yet again, the power of the dog walk. I go to the park with my dog, and it changes everything. I was in Ibiza last weekend, and I do this all the time. I took 12 people in my, I had a villa, and I invited 12 of my friends for my fiance's birthday. So I had a house full of them, and then we had like 12 other people come. So there's 25 people all relying on me to sort out their lives for them, where we're going for dinner, blah, 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 all of this stuff. And when you've got that amount of people and that amount of Sagittarians like living in one house, there was like 5 different Sagittarians. And it was like, you know, I'm not big on star signs, but when it comes to Sagittarians, they're all the fucking same, right? You know, you've got every ego under the sun all in one house. Everyone was drinking, everyone was taking drugs, everyone was partying. Some people had never been to Ibiza before. So they were like, you know, oh my God, that, you know.
Yeah.
Like throwing a stick for a dog, right? Bringing their tennis, it just went on. And it got to the point where I was like, oh, I can't deal with this anymore. I have to go. And I literally just stormed off from the restaurant, and I was with Stabby, and he'd been drinking, because he's not an addict. He can drink. He's a funny drunk. But at that point, I was like, right, I've had enough. You're not even with me either. And I stormed off, and up walks this guy I know with 2 rescue dogs. And the dog was called Richard. And it was a puppy, and it just arrived an hour before from Hungary. And I was like, oh, my God. And I just picked the dog up and was stroking the dog for 5 minutes, talking to him. And everything changed.
Isn't that amazing?
Everything changed. I went back into the restaurant. I apologized to everyone. I was like, look, guys, I'm sorry. And I had
with
the
dog.
Yeah, with the dog. And they, you know, and I gave the dog back about a half an hour later to this guy who I knew. And that was it. It just changed everything.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It really is. It's just, you know what? It's so grounding.
How does Stavros do with your sobriety? Is it a thing, like, you talk about it, or?
He doesn't need to deal with it. He just, without sobriety, I wouldn't have anything.
Does he understand it? Because saying that is because I don't bring my sobriety in my house only by my actions and how I am.
Yeah, and we lead by example.
Yeah.
And everything I do and everything I have comes from the fact of the things that I don't do. So by me not drinking and me not partaking in partying with substances means I have an incredible life, and which makes his life better. That's how he deals with it, by going to Balenciaga probably twice a week, or having the lifestyle that he has, or flying in business class.
Yeah.
You know, those things, we have this deal, Balenciaga or business. And 9 times out of 10, it's always like the clothes. Yeah. So he'll travel economy.
But he's young, right? 30.
Yeah, he's 30. He's just turned 31 last week. And, you know, there's a lot of other shit to deal with, but that's far bigger than my sobriety in his world. Do you get what I mean? Yeah, yeah. He respects that I don't drink and take no drugs. But, you know, this relationship's the first relationship I've ever been in where I don't have to worry. Because every other relationship I've been in, I've been with addicts. I've been drawn to the disease.
Yeah.
I've not gone out with the person. I've gone out with the addict. And this time I'm not going out with the addict. I'm going out. I'm in love with the person.
When you reconnected,
remarkable thing.
Was that a conscious thing? Did you know that? Because when I met my wife, I'd been off of relationships for another year or so because I was like, it's just the same thing for me. It's a nightmare. Not all of them, but some of them. And when I met her, I was really took my time, and I really wanted her to like me for me, not for what I did or anything else, and vice versa. Was that a conscious thing?
I'm in a relationship where I love, I can love someone because I've learned to love myself again.
And which is so powerful.
It really is. And just to be in a, to be in the room is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's not about I anymore. It's about us. Never had that in my life before. It's always been about me.
And you have to love yourself, like you said, which is a big journey for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a massive journey. And, you know, I truly believe that the power of I Don't Take Requests, the book, changed everything for me. And Stabby was a gift from God at the right time. It really was, without sounding like a wanker. It came at the right time. It changed. Yeah. It came on the end of that relationship where I was probably at one of my lowest vulnerable places after writing a book. I'd had stalkers from the fellowship. I'd gone through all of this stuff. I got to a point where I thought, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And when I say this, I wasn't sure what it was that I couldn't do because there were so many things going on. I couldn't pinpoint the one thing that was where the chaos was coming from, although it probably was the ex-boyfriend and, you know, so many things.
So many dramas
going on. I was on that drama triangle, firmly on it, on all three sides. And it was about stepping back from everything and reevaluating who I was and what I wanted in life for the first time at 15 years.
Yeah.
I've been sober 15 years. Of still being on the drama, on and off the drama triangle.
But all of those experiences, probably when you've actually had enough at that point, just reaffirm why you're doing what you're doing and how beautiful it is now.
Honestly, I've gone through everything I've gone through in my life to get to this point.
What advice would you give to the listeners that either have drink or drug problems, maybe they're not sure or they are completely in it? What advice would you give to them?
Shut up and listen. You know, if someone tries to give you advice in a non-judgmental way, if someone says to you, look, I've done what you're doing and this is a way out, just listen. Just take it on board. You've got to remember, when if you've got someone in your family or you're related to someone or your partner is in active addiction or of any sort, or, you know, or is an active alcoholism, the last thing they want is you to judge them. Just show them love and show them, be there for them. Be there for them. Just let them know that you're there. You know, because for me, I'm a firm believer about intervention doesn't always work. What it does is it pushes people underground. Mm. And the last thing you need to do is you just need to show support. Even though you don't agree with it, support them. Just say, look, and wait for that moment, because that moment will come. That magical moment where, you know, the pilot light comes back on, that's when you need to pounce. That's when you need to turn the heating up.
It's true.
There's no point in turning the gas up if you ain't got nothing to light it.
You know, no, I mean? Pilot light.
Right? And I just think, you know, for me, the turning point was the moment I started to listen to my own gut and listen to my own head. Because my head would just tell me a million and one things because I had no clarity.
It's amazing.
Mm.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Paul.
Cheers, buddy. This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can. And head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. A big thank you to Fat Tony today, who's been a great guest. And if you want to find out more about his book or the film coming out, please check the show notes. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.